Well, thank you. Thank you very much. You're able to hear me fine, okay? Is that right? I came in from my part of the country, Southern California, yesterday, and discovered that this time of the year, you are bound to receive a warm welcome in Oklahoma. Today, I asked my driver on the way over to this church if we could stop and give me a chance to do some jogging. And he said, well, if you want to break a sweat, just roll down the window. He was right about that. One thing I like about Oklahoma is the shape, the outline of the state on the U.S. map. You know, you always wonder, don't you, when you look at something like that, how did they come up with that? Right? I mean, is there a river that's that straight that runs along the northern edge of the panhandle? I just don't think so. But it is helpful when you're someone like me and you like to travel and know where you are at any given time, because the shape of the state of Oklahoma is so distinctive that you can look out the airplane and see it and know you're in Oklahoma airspace. It's not like that in Iowa or Kansas or Colorado. You can get them confused. Well, I'm from Southern California, and that explains why sometimes what I think is a sense of humor doesn't make much sense. So you're not obliged to laugh at all. But I'm going to pick up where Bill Craig began, in effect, with his presentation of the structure of the case for Christian belief by going back to the beginning, which is quite literally the beginning of the history of the universe. But to place this in a context, I want you to see with me what three verses of Scripture have to say about this. Genesis 1:1 says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Psalm 19:1 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork." So we have the juxtaposition not only of credit given to God for his handiwork, but an appreciation for it as evidence not only that he exists, but of his glory, his greatness. And then the New Testament passage in Romans 1:20, which heads the outline for this presentation on page 7, "For since the creation of the world, his," that is God's, "invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made." And we're now going to take that as a departure point in crafting arguments based on what has been seen to an inference that God is the creator. It's one thing to read that in the Bible. It's another to see for ourselves that this is strongly in evidence apart from what the Scriptures actually tell us. You don't depend exclusively on what the Bible says for confidence that God exists. Now, I want to share with you a couple of personal anecdotes to provide some personal context for this. Some years ago, I was returning home from a trip similar to this one. I had been speaking at a conference, and I was unusually tired. I enjoy conversation with passengers who are interested in engaging, but this particular time, I was not really open to that. I was tired, and I just sort of wanted to be left alone. And I thought, maybe I ought to take some special precautions so that I can avoid being drawn into conversation by someone who is especially disposed to that sort of thing. And so I'm going to be revealing to you some of my own weakness as I tell you what transpired. I pulled out a book, a thick book, in the philosophy of religion, my field, and I had it ready so that, if necessary, I could appear to be reading it. Now, I was actually too tired to read the book, but that didn't matter as long as it looked like I was reading the book. I thought I might not be disturbed. So I had my props in place, And it was supposed to be a full flight, so I fully expected that the seat next to me, the center seat, would be occupied. And sure enough, it was. In fact, I detected who it was that was going to sit there, partly because of my pessimism, when I saw him board the plane and he looked like the life of the party. And he came down and he sat down, and almost instantly you could see that this is what he wanted to do. Well, I made every effort to avoid conversation with him. And I could tell, using my peripheral vision, highly trained peripheral vision, that he was just waiting, you know, to jump into conversation with the least opportunity. And so it took all, I had to exercise more energy probably avoiding conversation than I would have if I'd have just gone along with it. But I'm stubborn sometimes. And so for about half the flight home, a couple of hours, we were fine. And then I heard a female voice say, "Sir, would you like some water?" And after the second time I heard it, I realized she was speaking to me. And it was a flight attendant who was offering me water, and I was thirsty. So I thought, I'll say yes, but I've got to be very careful. Because as I turn from my seat next to the window, I have to do this, and I'll be turning towards this gentleman. I didn't actually know, you know, what he would do. So I did this. I said, "Thank you." And as I started to kind of get back into my comfortable zone, he leaped into the fray. And he said, "Hey, what's that you're reading?" Now, here's where confessions come in. I said, "It's a book." I did. I said, that's what I actually said. Well, not to be deterred, he said, "What's it about?" Well, now, usually when I declare the nature of the work I do and call myself a philosopher, even if I don't want this to happen, people will leave the room. So I said, "Well, this is a book in philosophy." And I tried to make it sound awful. And he said, "Oh, well, are you a philosopher?" And I said, "Well, yes, I teach philosophy at the university level." And he said, "Really? I have always wanted to talk to a philosopher." Everything I've just told you is true. And so I closed my book and I said to him, "What would you like to talk about?" And here's what he said. He's probably in his mid-20s, and he says, "I have a good job, and I have a good friend on my job who likes to talk about issues, politics and religion, as I do. But we disagree on pretty much everything." And he said, "You're a philosopher, so I'm hoping that as we talk, you'll be able to give me ammunition to talk to my friend who believes that God exists." So I said, "Well, I think you came to the right place." And then I said, "Well, let me ask you a question." I said, "If you disagree with him, I presume then that you're an agnostic or an atheist, a skeptic of some sort." He said, "Yes, I don't believe that God exists. I believe that God does not exist." So I said this, I said, "What do you believe instead?" And he said, "Well, I believe in a higher power." I said, "Okay, can you tell me what you mean by that?" And he looked at me like, "You can't possibly be a philosopher if you don't know what a higher power is." But I waited, and he kind of got the point. This is a non-rhetorical question. And so he said, "Okay, I'll tell you what it is." He said, "A higher power..." And I'll never forget his words. I can quote them verbatim. He said, "A higher power is a power that is really high." That's what he said. And at this point, I'm thinking everybody on the plane knows what's going on because he's very animated. So then I asked him a third question. I said, "Can you tell me why you believe in a higher power?" And he said, yeah, look around. Okay, so I'm looking around, but I'm not sure what I'm supposed to see. I'm not seeing a higher power. He says, look out there and look at the ground. I said, yeah, okay, what? He said, it's got to come from somewhere. There's got to be some explanation for why there is a universe. It's going to have to be a higher power. And I said, well, I think you make a pretty good point there. But I don't understand. I said, I don't understand why you would take that to be evidence that a higher power exists, but not have any inclination to believe that God exists. Because the evidence that you're talking about actually is strong evidence for the existence of God, and there is no higher power than that. Well, he didn't care much for that inference. So for the next hour and a half, we had a very stimulating, let me put it this way, stimulating conversation. If he wasn't converted, maybe somebody else listening in the back of the plane was. I just don't know. More recently, I was on my motorcycle. I had ridden from my place in Southern California to Phoenix for a conference, and I decided I would spend a few extra days riding around in Arizona doing a loop. And I connected up with Highway 66, the old Highway 66, and I came down through there. And there is a section on the highway where you go past a peak and get ready to go up through the Black Mountains. And you come to this little place called Cool Springs. And that's all of it right there in the top left corner. And you meet a gentleman. He looks gentle, doesn't he? Down there in the bottom right-hand corner. If you go in there and you buy a Coke or a trinket or whatever to remember this place by. And we got into a conversation. And finally he says, well, now what do you do for a living? And I said, well, I teach philosophy. He says, philosophy. Would you humor me a little and tell me what that means? And so I gave him some notions about what philosophers do. And I mentioned along the way that one thing that we're interested in is how to make sense of life and whether life has meaning. If so, on what basis? And he said, oh, so what do you think about the meaning of life? What is it? And then he didn't even give me a chance to answer. He said, it really doesn't have any meaning. And I said, well, why do you say that? And we were off and running. But at one point, we were talking about the natural world all over again. And I said to him, he was quite convinced that there is no God, because there's no good argument for it. And so I said to him, then how do you account for the existence of the universe, which has not always existed? And he had nothing to say. Now that is all it took in that case to bring a skeptic to a point where he couldn't respond to a demand for evidence for his own point of view. This is why I ask people, if you don't believe in God, what do you believe instead? And will it suffice in response to the challenges we have for explaining things around us? We're talking about that here tonight. Now, I'm going to show you this little clip here from the movie Contact. And it's a movie many of you have seen, I'm sure, and you might recognize this scene. It represents two very typical but highly unsatisfactory attitudes about this question of science in relationship to the existence of God. It's a conversation between a scientist and maybe you'd call him a religionist. Let's go ahead and see this. We might need more volume.
Wow. You look beautiful, Ellie.
So do you.
Yeah, I really do.
I read your book.
Here we go.
Would you like me to quote you? ironically, the thing that people are most hungry for, meaning, is the one thing that science hasn't been able to give them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on. It's like you're saying that science killed God. What if science simply revealed that he never existed in the first place?
I think we're going to need to get some air.
What?
And a few more of these.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Whew, a little chilly out here.
Yeah, this is nice.
I got one for you.
What do you got?
Occam's Razor. You've ever heard of it?
Occam's Razor. It sounds like some slasher movie.
No, Occam's Razor. It's a basic scientific principle. And it says, all things being equal, the simplest explanation tends to be the right one.
Makes sense to me.
All right. So what's more likely? Thank you.
You're welcome.
An all-powerful, mysterious God created the universe and then decided not to give any proof of his existence? Or that he simply doesn't exist at all and that we created him so we wouldn't have to feel so small and alone?
I don't know. I couldn't imagine living in a world where God didn't exist. I wouldn't want to.
How do you know you're not deluding yourself? I mean, for me, I'd need proof.
Proof? Did you love your father?
What?
Your dad, did you love him?
Yes, very much.
Prove it.
Saved by the Bell. Now, which perspective do you find most sympathetic? If you're a religious believer, you might want to say his. If you're a skeptic with a fascination with the significance of science for the world today, you might say her. But I'm more sympathetic with her than I am with him. And I believe that God exists. He was not prepared to give her any evidence for the existence of God. And she gave him a perfect opening. When you leave this conference, among other things, you will be able to present evidence to people that supports your belief that God exists, or if you don't believe that God exists, you may be haunted by this evidence. It's this evidence that we will be talking about here. Now, before we do, I want to relate this to a problem that Bill Craig, my colleague, alluded to, spoke briefly about, actually, in his session a bit ago, the problem of divine hiddenness. And so you'll see in your outline, point number 2 on page 7, that I've got a discussion of this. And I want to give you a general statement of the problem and then unpack it a little bit and describe a way to respond. The general problem, you'll recall, is that people sometimes believe that the absence of evidence for God's existence is evidence that God does not exist. And the reason why they think that is because they think that if God did exist, there would be stronger evidence that he exists than there actually is. Now, this is one kind of problem for the skeptic, and it's another kind of problem for the believer. So it includes us all. For the skeptic, the problem is looking out on the world, contemplating his own experience, listening to the evidence and the arguments presented, and still feeling that it all comes up short. There just isn't good reason to believe that God exists. Now, he's got 2 reasons, he thinks, to believe that God does not exist. First, he has no good evidence, and he doesn't want to believe without evidence. That's his view. And second, he thinks that because there's no evidence, that is evidence that he doesn't exist. Because again, if he did, that is, if God did, there would be evidence forthcoming. Now, why does he think that? Because he thinks that God is the sort of being who would want his creatures to know that he exists. This would be a function of his love for humanity. If God exists, then God is utterly worthy of worship, but wouldn't be if he wasn't perfectly loving. And that means he would want us to know of his existence and be able to be in relationship with him on some level. That is something many skeptics believe. But believing that, they think that there is no such evidence, and so we have evidence that God does not exist. Now, that's a problem for the skeptic. For the believer, the problem is as follows. This believer thinks that God does exist, and maybe thinks there's very good evidence for the existence of God, and has frequently rehearsed the evidence for himself, for others, and presented that, and thought it very compelling. Does this provide a sufficient response for his own satisfaction in dealing with this problem of divine hiddenness? Well, a skeptic might say it shouldn't, and for the following reason. The skeptic might say to the believer, well, you think that you have ample evidence for the existence of God, and that's all very well and good, but I'm telling you that I don't. And that should be a problem not only for me, but for you. Because the God you believe in is the sort of being who would, if he wanted to, provide evidence for me, but hasn't, and if he existed, he would want to. So my lack of evidence overwhelms your sense that you have adequate evidence. You see the problem? So we should have some kind of answer to this, and I'd like to talk briefly about that. I'm not going to say much about 2.31, but it has to do with this idea, non-evidentialist response would simply say that you can have justified belief that God exists even if it's not grounded in what many people think of as evidence, like arguments for the existence of God. And Bill did a great job talking about one way to think about that when he was talking about how we have direct acquaintance with things like our own minds, the minds of other people, the existence of a physical world, sometimes called an external world because it's external to ourselves, and so on. We don't try to give arguments for those sorts of things, and if we did, we'd fall short, but we don't doubt that they're true. Because we do have evidence of a sort, it's just evidence that is direct through our acquaintance with those things. And it might be possible to have that kind of encounter with God that would give you that kind of justification for believing in God, but you wouldn't have an argument. And it wouldn't be evidence that you could give someone else because they would have to have their own encounter. That's one approach. But the evidentialist really does want to say, but there is a way to talk about evidence for the skeptic who gets hung up on this point. And here's how I would do it. I would say, start with the concept of God and emphasize the following two things first and foremost. First, that God is utterly worthy of worship. Now, God may not exist, but I think it is a conceptual truth that if God does exist, then this has to be true about God. If God does not exist, well, then there's something that is sort of the greatest thing that does exist. But it doesn't qualify as God just because it's the greatest thing that exists if it's not worthy of worship. So you could have the concept of God that includes this, his utter worship worthiness, and yet think that there is no God. Now, together with that is the second point, and that is that God is perfectly loving. You see, God isn't worthy of worship, if he exists, just because he's the greatest thing out there, all-powerful, all-knowing, and so forth. It's going to be because, in part, he is also omnibenevolent. So he's omnipotent, yes, he's omniscient, yes, but he's omnibenevolent, that is, he is morally perfect. And he wouldn't be worthy of worship if he was omniscient and omnipotent, but lacked omnibenevolence, or so I think at least. Now, some people worship beings they call deities or gods that fall short of this conception of God because they don't think that this conception of God matches anything in the real world. So they're kind of stuck with a lower level reality, but it's the best there is. And I want to say it's a mistake to call that God if this is the right way to think about what it would mean for there to be a God, you see. So now then, having thought through the concept of God, with the open question, does this concept answer to anything in the real world, that is to say, really exists, I don't mean in the physical world, but just exists, we might want to consider what kind of evidence a being of that sort would provide if he existed and wanted you to know it. That's an interesting question. Now, there might be evidence that God sort of can't help but provide because of things he's done. If he created the universe and his fingerprints are all over it, you know, he becomes a suspect, and what can he do? You know, it's a consequence of creating the universe. Maybe it's a secondary fact about God's intentions. His real intention was just to create a world. He didn't really care whether people believed in him or not, but, you know, it kind of gives him away. That's a possibility. But what we're considering here is not what kind of evidence there might be that God did exist, whether he planned it that way or not, but what kind of evidence he would give us if he was worthy of worship, morally perfect, and wanted us to believe. And here's what I think. He wants more than just our conviction that there's a God. You see, he doesn't want us just to believe a proposition. The proposition, God exists, is true. Now, if God exists, it is true. And it would be good to believe it simply because it's true. We are inherently, we are naturally, I should say, all of us, truth interested. And we are exquisitely evidence sensitive. Now, that's something we'll come back to. But what I'm stressing at this point is to contemplate what this kind of being might provide in the way of evidence if he wanted us to believe in a way that mattered to him and not just to us. And all too many people settle for believing in the propositional sense, just tell me, does God exist or not, and let me get back to life. Now I want to give you a definition, my definition of secularism. A pervasive attitude in our culture today. I think that secularism is little more than an attitude that God, if he even bothers to exist, is irrelevant. And so it can be an interesting intellectual exercise to contemplate the arguments and go through them all and then come to the conclusion, yes, God exists. But then just go on with your life, acting as if it makes no difference. Now, do you think God is interested in that? You see, when a skeptic says, the evidence should be there because surely God would want us to believe that he exists, he misses what kind of belief God would want us to have. It's not just propositional. It's also going to be relational. Right? God is going to want us, he's going to want to have our hearts and not just some aspect of our minds. But he might not be willing to provide you with evidence that would, in a way, force you to worship him, which wouldn't be worship because you wouldn't be doing it freely. You see, a worship-worthy being who is perfectly loving cannot be worshipped except freely. And so he can't present evidence to you that would, in effect, force you to go through the motions of worship if you really didn't want to. And so I believe there is a kind of evidence that God can give you that I cannot, that no one at this conference can, but that I have, and that many people do, that God alone provides, but only under certain conditions. And those are conditions that God wills. We have to be willing to be submissive to his will, come what may, understanding that he is worthy of our worship and perfectly loving if it should happen that he exists. And that is a very important question to ask the skeptic. I debated an atheist a couple of years ago from the northern part of the Midwest, but we were in the South where we did the debate. And after the debate, where I had made this point, we went way into the early hours of the morning at a Denny's next door to our hotel talking about this point. And I said, would you at least be willing to say, if God exists and this is what it means for God to be God, then I would happily seek to fulfill his will, whatever it is, come what may. Because after all, we're talking about a perfectly loving God who wouldn't want anything but your best. And you know what he said? I would choose not to do that. And I said, can you give me a reason for that? And he said, no. It's just my choice. And that's my point. But he said other people might make that decision and it wouldn't be irrational. Very interesting concession. And I think that the kind of evidence that God provides under those conditions, even though we fallibly move towards God in this way, is through our conscience and our experience of moral truths and moral reality, our own failure and our dependence on a holy God to live our lives. So I want to commend to you the availability of evidence that God himself can give you, but only if you come to that with the right attitude, because he will not coerce belief of the sort that issues in worship. And if you're content to just believe a proposition, then he might just say, fine, you know, listen to Guyvet. You know, if that's all you want. But I want to say that's not all there is. You understand? The importance of that. Okay, but now then, let's go to arguments, evidence that is publicly available, right? That we can collectively consider, talk about together, and think about as possible support for the existence of God. And we're only going to bite off a bit of the evidence. We're going to look at one kind of argument, and it's only one kind of argument. This is a cosmological argument for the existence of God. It's a version of that. A cosmological argument for the existence of God is an argument that infers the existence of God as the explanation for the existence of the cosmos. That's why it's called that, the cosmological argument. So the universe, if you like, the world as we know it, right, can be explained in virtue of thinking that God is its creator. That is characteristic of cosmological arguments. But there are different versions. And again, my colleague, Bill, gave two versions. One from contingency, the contingency of the universe, as he described. And the other, briefly stated, as an argument from the origin of the universe. And that's the one we're going to look at more fully now. Now, this argument is sometimes called the Kalam cosmological argument because it was developed during the medieval period among a group of Islamic scholars, Arabic scholars, who believed that God existed and thought about reasons to do so, and hammered out an argument along these lines. And this fit a tradition of natural theology in their religious context that we could say was called Kalam. And so Bill Craig, in fact, I think, is really responsible for bringing back into the discussion today this really ancient argument that has not been refuted, and to enjoy the benefits of it without drawing the same conclusions that a Muslim might about what God is like or has revealed. So that's just a bit of history. I won't go into any other details or talk about early critics of the argument, but there have been some from the beginning. But it is important to emphasize the pattern of the argument. And I should have gone up here to this. And because of the way the slides are designed, you're going to see on the screen each of the four points that subdivide this section of the outline. So there's the background to the argument that I've just sort of briefly surveyed for you. And then we'll consider this a statement of the argument in two forms. We'll look at a short version and then a long version. And then we'll look at a list of objections to the argument with an interest in answering those. And I'll say a few things about how we might use this argument ourselves with others. But let's go back then to, we'll skip a slide that speaks of background and just go to statement of the argument, which is in the outline. And I have to say something about the pattern of the argument first. This is an argument that is called inference to the best explanation. That's the type of argument it is. So you encounter something that is, on some level, puzzling, peculiar, mysterious, and you're interested in an explanation for it. Remember I said we are truth interested. We are inquisitive. We are intellectually curious, at least until it gets beat out of us. Sometimes it happens when people are 3 years old. Sometimes it's 12 years old. Sometimes they have to be 50 years old. But you should always be intellectually curious. It is part of being human. And when you encounter a puzzling phenomenon, however large or small it may be, oftentimes you want to understand it. Here's a simple example. A few weeks ago, I set out to replace the plumbing in our house, a house built in the 1960s with galvanized pipe. And so we were experiencing various problems, constricted flow and so forth. And so to save money, I decided I would do this myself. Now, I know what you're thinking, a philosopher. You know, what could he possibly be thinking? It's a good question. What was I thinking? 12 days later, having done most of the work just by myself, crawling under the house and doing everything else, yelling at my wife, so that she could help me get something somewhere, and then sometimes yelling at who knows what because something didn't go right. And then that moment, right, that critical moment when you turn it on, the water goes on. Now, I had to do things in a complicated way. I didn't want to do the simple thing, the smart thing. I had to do a complicated thing. So I built a manifold so that I could run the water from ports from the manifold to the different individual faucets. So hot shower, cold shower. Hot sink, cold sink. Dishwasher, washing machine. You see, you get the picture. So I have all these things coming out of this manifold, and each one goes to something. So each one's got to work in its own right. And the manifold is fed by the main, all right? So there's a lot that could go wrong, and you have to test each one of these and hope you don't have any leaks. And I think plumbers would say, well, don't count on that. First, because it seldom happens that you don't have leaks, even if you're a professional. And second, you're not. So I was expecting, you know, reasonable results, not necessarily professional results. And so, you know, if you start the dishwasher and the toilet flushes, it's like, okay, now I know how to flush a toilet. Now I got to figure out how I run the dishwasher. You can kind of get used to that, you know, as long as you live in the house for the rest of your life. Now, that didn't happen, thankfully. But here's what did happen. The only problem I really encountered, I didn't have any leaks, but the only problem I really had was that in one of the bathrooms, when I turned the water on, nothing came out. Now, that's sort of the opposite of a leak, isn't it? And I wasn't counting on that. I said, wait a minute. This is not what you're supposed to get. You're supposed to get leaks, not nothing. So I'm trying to figure out, is there no water getting to this? But I could tell that there was. The hot water line, the red line, was warm, right up to the faucet. What's going on here? Well, eventually, seeking a good explanation for it, I started looking into it, and I twisted the aerator off, which is that little thing that water pours through before, as you know, before you can use it. to put it technically. And do you know what I saw? There was a wood chip wedged in there, just the point of it, wedged in one part of it, and that alone was preventing the flow. Or so I surmised. That counted for me as a reasonably good explanation, you understand. And so I plucked it out, screwed that thing back on there, crossed my fingers, and turned on the water, and you know what happened? It came on. It worked. That's all it was. I had figured out the explanation to the puzzle. Now, that's natural for us. Sometimes we have to get things to work. Sometimes we just want to because of our curiosity. Other times we feel as if the significance of our life depends on it. And I think that making sense of the existence of the universe is one of those things. That it stands to reason that whatever it is that makes sense of life has a lot to do with how it got here. And so we're looking for the best explanation for something of that sort. Now, it's also a probabilistic argument. This doesn't guarantee that you're making no mistakes or that the evidence just entails of necessity that God exists. It's a probability argument, and that's a good argument. Most of the things we believe on the basis of argument, we believe on the basis of probabilities. Not certainties, but probabilities. Probabilities are a guide to the truth. And if the probability is that God exists, then that's what you should believe. This is the kind of argument it is. Now, though it is technically sophisticated, this argument also is intuitively accessible and plausible. And I think you'll see that. Now, I'm not going to say anything here about the place of this argument within the total case for Christian belief, but I want you to think about that. Maybe I should just say this much. If, in fact, the universe owes its existence to a creator of great power and intelligence, to say nothing of other things that are relevant, then when you look at particular features of the universe, like fine-tuning and other evidences of design, you've got background evidence that that is attributable to the creator. And so you have corroborating evidence, right, on top of evidence. And you also have a way to circumvent certain objections to using the design argument because you've already got a good reason to think that the universe was created. If you think it wasn't, then you might say, well, we have to explain design away. But if you think it was created by a personal being, where are you going to turn to make sense of apparent design? To that being, hence, a designer. So the connections between arguments can be very important. In relation to special evidences for Christianity, I think this is one of several arguments that actually gives us a reason to think that, in fact, God does want us to know Him on a personal level, but that He recognizes our limitations and has to overcome those. And those limitations have to do with ignorance, the finite span in which we live our lives, that is, we all die, and our spiritual or moral problem that is an obstacle to relationship to a morally perfect being. And in the interest in overcoming those things, He will provide some revelation of His remedy for that predicament that we're in. And there are ways to test that hypothesis. And when tested, I think we encounter evidence of the resurrection of Jesus, for example, that shows us what that solution is. So these arguments come together in various ways. Now, what are the advantages of this argument? It's intersectarian appeal. That just means any monotheist, Christian or not, might find this argument useful. It has a simple and easy-to-remember structure. There are four independent lines of argument for the most crucial premise. That's convenient. So there are four different ways to come at that premise. If one doesn't satisfy, then you turn to the other three. And then fourth, it appeals to science in support of the crucial premise. And you know how impressed people are today by science, right? And so there's the general influence of science on the popular level among people, and the lasting consensus among scientists who are called cosmologists. And if you have evidence of that sort, then that ought to be that much more persuasive. So what is the argument? Well, here we come now to the statement of the argument itself. And here's the short version. And it really is short. I've put it in bold print, right, on page 9. That's where we are, by the way, in this oddly designed outline. But you'll see that 4.1 is the short argument and 4.11 is the first premise. 4.12 is the second. So what is the first premise? What does it say? Yes, whatever begins to exist has a cause. That's the first premise. Second premise, the universe began to exist. Can you say that for me? Good. Now, does anything follow from these two premises? Can you figure out what comes next? Don't look. Don't look down. Look up. Okay? Premise number one, let's say it together. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Premise number two, the universe began to exist. Therefore, now how did you know that? Because it follows necessarily from the premises. And I actually wrote it down there, 4.13, therefore the universe has a cause. That's the argument. You think you can remember that? You say, well, sure, but can I believe it? Well, let's think about it. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Well, what else is going to explain the beginning of the existence of anything? You know, given the evidence that we have for the coming to be of things with which we are familiar, there is really zero probability that there's something out there that came into existence without a cause. See, relative to the evidence we have of the actual coming to be of things, which all have causes, we have zero probability that there's something that comes to be without a cause. Also, this is a basic principle of reasoning that I think we just intuitively know to be true. And certainly it would be odd for any of us to come across something that we could be sure did not have a cause. Usually what scientists do when they can't find the cause for something is they just keep looking. They don't say, oh, well, there's probably no cause for that. Maybe only with the origin of the universe will we do that. There's special reasons why people might do that, because they don't do that with anything else. So whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Should we believe that? Well, this is the crucial premise, and there are four lines of evidence for this, and they can be broken up into two parts. Philosophical arguments and scientific evidence. Now, there are two arguments from the domain of philosophy that the universe began to exist. One is from the impossibility of an actually infinite collection of things. Now, I want to refer you to the excellent chapter 4 in this book that you received with your conference registration, chapter by in Bill's book, On Guard, developing how this argument works. It's a fascinating argument. I want to focus on the second one, the argument from the impossibility of forming an infinite collection or series of things by successive addition. But I'm going to show you that when we come to the longer version. Okay? So that's separate. But the basic idea here is that if the universe has always existed, in other words, if premise number two is false, it did not begin to exist, but has always existed, if that's true, then the series of events that makes up the history of the universe would have to be infinite. It'd be like an infinite collection of things. But if an infinite collection of things is impossible, well, then that can't be, and so the universe has to have a beginning. It has to be temporally finite. Alternatively, if it's impossible for you to go from a set that is finite or a collection of things that's finite, and then somehow by adding one thing to the set or the collection after another, It's impossible for that set to ever become infinite. It'll always be finite even as it grows in its size. And so if that's the way the history of the universe comes to be as a collection of events, well, then it has to have a beginning. And when it comes to explaining the origin of the universe, many scientists will just say, well, you know, that's not a scientific problem. But does that mean it's not a problem? Maybe it's not a scientific problem. Do you just say, well, no problem because it's not scientific? That's a kind of worry that some people raise. But we're going to say that there is scientific evidence because we're at least brought to the brink. The universe had a beginning. And the Big Bang cosmology is evidence for that because it's evidence that the universe exploded into existence in some fashion of an explosion a finite time ago. Maybe it was 13 billion years ago, maybe 20, maybe less than 13, you know. And they try to figure out within some margin of error how long ago it was. And that's another interesting thing, is that they can't really get very precise in their measurements of these things. And they change, too. But the basic evidence that the universe exploded into existence is the same. So part of that evidence is of the observation of something called the red shift in light that's emitted as you observe its behavior in space. And this allows scientists to extrapolate back in time to the source. And it has to have one. That's crucial. The red shift. Prior to this observation that was made, there were actual theoretical developments that led scientists to expect that the universe would have a beginning. And so they were looking for things that would confirm that. And then the red shift provided them with that evidence, but it would have anyway without that expectation. There are other things, something called the cosmic background radiation is further scientific evidence of the same sort. Some have said that because, this is another point, that because galaxies move further away from our own at a faster rate, the further they are from ours. You can't really see this happening. I mean, it's not going to help to go out on your porch tonight and look for this. But because that happens, this is thought by some to be evidence as well. So many of us say, well, I guess we have to kind of take their word for it, right? Because this is complex. Yes and no. I think that to understand the physics of it, yes, it's very sophisticated, it's very subtle. And there are new developments on a regular basis, but there's a consensus that you can appeal to. And you don't have to be able, you don't have to be a cosmologist to bring out into the open this evidence as evidence that the universe had a beginning. Very seldom have I had to do that. Even with, from the most sophisticated people I've talked to those who, you know, have a high school diploma and that's all. You just remind them that this is the accepted view. But if you want to learn more, as I hope you do, you can do no better than to begin your education again by reading the details in this chapter. It really is very good. And with that, maybe new questions about the details will lead you to more material. But for others of you, this will be enough. And for all of us, we can say, but look what people, what scientists today are saying. Now, the second line of scientific evidence is that there are these fundamental laws of thermodynamics, all of which are interesting and salient here, but the second of which is the most sort of obviously significant. And that is the law that describes the increase in entropy. Right, as the energy in the universe is diffused and, in effect, used up over time. Now, it'll take a long time because there's a lot of energy. But it's supposed to happen eventually because there's no infusion of new energy into the universe. And so it's like fuel being burned up. You know, eventually the universe will run out of gas in one way or another. Now, why is that evidence that the universe had a beginning? That sounds like evidence that it's going to have an end. Well, it's because if it's going to end, then it must have had a beginning. Why? Couldn't something that never began cease to exist? Here's the problem. If something that's always existed and hence is made up of infinitely many events, let's say, is eventually going to have a last event and stop existing, why hasn't it happened yet? There's been plenty of time for it. You see the problem? See, does it have, we just need one more event before it happens, or whatever they can extrapolate into the future. Why has the universe waited so long to die? If it's had an infinite amount of time in which to do it. You see the intuition here? That's the problem. So, what's the first premise? Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Second premise, the universe began to exist. Conclusion, therefore the universe has a cause. Now somebody's going to say, oh wait a minute, I don't hear anything about God in this. Look at the next point, 4.14. The cause of the universe must have certain properties. Whatever properties are required to bring the universe into existence, right, out of nothing, by the way, using no raw materials. Because there's no space and time, you know, like first or before this, you know, that God can mess with and then get a universe. No, that's the point. Something comes from nothing. But it's not from nothing in the way that nothing could cause it, right? Nothing does that. And I mean, nothing does it in the sense that it doesn't do it. If you know what I mean. So what properties would this being have to have? Well, it's got to be non-temporal because it creates time. It's got to be non-spatial because there is no space apart from the production of the universe. The cause must be non-physical. Duh. The cause must exercise free choice. This is an interesting one. Because if the cause is non-temporal, non-physical, then there's got to be some explanation for the origin of the universe, right? Because otherwise we have a similar problem to the one we mentioned earlier, where it'd be like, well, why didn't it just already happen? But there's got to be a decision of a sort, a willing that this thing be. If the will was always there, well, then the universe would always be there. But it hasn't been. And if the will was never there, well, then it wouldn't happen. So there's a willing, and it's a free choice, a self-directedness of the agent responsible personally for making it happen. Also, the cause must have enough power and intelligence to create a universe using no raw materials. You might say, oh, well, okay, I didn't hear you say omnipotence there. I didn't hear you say omniscience there. Fine. But do you have any idea how much power would be required to bring a universe into existence out of nothing? Can you tell me what the limit is? You know, what you could get away with without omnipotence? Look, if a creator did that and he said, by the way, I am omnipotent, I don't think I'd disagree with him. And I think he's liable to be more intelligent about such things than I am. And apparently the cause acted for a reason, has a motive. Okay, so what? Well, next premise, any being that has these properties is entitled to be God, called God, therefore God exists. Now, is there more that we could say about God in an ideal conception of God? Of course there is, but you don't try to squeeze more out of an argument than is available to you in the resources of the argument. That's part of being intellectually honest. And so we say what we can, which is a lot, about why we should believe that God exists. And then we link it up with other evidences that will tell us even more about God. Now, what's the long form? I'm going to read these out to you, and then I'm going to explain just a bit of it. The physical universe exists. Second, the history of the universe is a series of events arrayed in temporal succession. That's kind of how they're ordered There's a structure of a temporal sort among things that are constituents of our universe. Third, either this series includes infinitely many events arrayed in temporal succession, or it has always existed and has always existed, or it's a series of finitely many events and the universe had a beginning. Those are your options. Fourth premise, the series does not include infinitely many events arrayed in temporal succession. It doesn't. Fifth, the series of events arrayed in temporal succession, then, is finite and the universe had a beginning. Number six, if the universe had a beginning, then the universe was caused to exist, or caused to begin to exist. Therefore, the universe was caused to exist. The cause of the beginning of the universe must transcend the physical universe and be non-temporal and have all these properties that we already spoke of. Therefore, number nine, naturalism is false and some form of supernaturalism is true. Number 10, theism is the simplest version of supernaturalism that explains the origin of the universe. Therefore, God exists. You don't multiply things to explain something if something simpler will do the trick. That was referred to as Occam's razor in the little clip. Now, where is the meat of this argument? Premise 4. The series does not include infinitely many events arrayed in temporal succession. We have reason to think that. Why is that? Why think that this isn't the case? Well, there are interesting ways to describe this. The basic idea is that you could pick any event, whether it's an event now occurring or something in the past, or one that might happen in the future, like we imagined with the death of the universe, and ask, if the universe never had a beginning, how many events would have to occur before that one that you picked could occur? And the answer would be infinitely many. So in a way, now we have the problem is that it would never occur because you can't complete a set like that. You can't produce movement towards a definite point when you've got to sort of, as it were, traverse infinitely many points first. That's a problem. Now, I can illustrate this problem. Let's suppose, we won't do it in the interest of time, but let's suppose this auditorium was full of people. There were 1,000 people in this room, and we decided that everybody in the front row would stand up. And I would say, okay, take turns sitting down, starting here and going to there. And there's Brian sitting over there, and that really is Brian. And Brian sits down last, okay? But we have a finite number of entities that are taking turns sitting down. That's successive change, successive events, right? They're occurring in temporal succession. So that's our analogy with the way the universe and its history is arrayed. But now then we add the second row and we say, okay, now start over there in the second row, go all the way down. When you get there, come back on the loop, and then Brian sits down. It'll take longer if we keep the rate change constant, but eventually he will sit down because the chain is finite. And we do this for the rest of the people in the auditorium, right? But the organizers of the conference ran into a little problem. The interest in this conference was so intense that there are infinitely many other people that want to be here. And they want to be in this room. And they want to play this game. They want to sit down with you. And so we invite them in and off, and here they come. Now I ask you, if we get infinitely many people involved in this little exercise, taking turns, right, sitting down, when will Brian eventually get to sit down? When will he sit down? Never! Poor Brian. But neither will any of you. Why? Because infinitely many will be ahead of you. And you can pick any one of them, and the same thing will be true of them, too. That's pretty bizarre. So you can do it with a finite number. You can't do it with infinitely many. The universe is enough like that for us to have reason to believe that it had a beginning. Do you think you could use that argument? You think you could make that point? You don't have to be a philosopher. Use extension cords. Okay? Plug it in. Now, to get power from the outlet to your lamp, you got to have a cord. So you plug it into your lamp and you come over here and it won't reach. So what do? You go get another extension cord that's either longer or probably more likely, you just add it to that one. And just hope, you know, the fire marshal doesn't show up. Now, he's got a real issue on his hands if you've got to keep going further and further back into infinity to get your charge to light up the light. He's going to have problems with how many you've set up, you know, to light your lamp, because that looks risky. But you can tell him, don't worry, there's no danger here, because the outlet is infinitely receding. And I'm never going to be able to plug this thing in. Then he's going to want to know, how can somebody smart enough to figure that out bother trying? Right? And people are like that when it comes to this argument. Now, there are any number of objections. Some of them are interesting, fascinating. Some are a little bit kind of scary at first. And then you think about them and it's not so bad. Others of them are, you have to mention them just because they get mentioned. So, for example, this is 5.2. I want you to skip to, let's see, which one? 5.24 on 11, page 11. Look at that one. What caused God? Now, that's the objection. It's actually a question, right? But in the question is the implication, God needs a cause. And if God needs a cause, well, then off you go, looking for causes of things, you know, back into infinity. And if God needs a cause, he can't be God either. Now, how do you respond to that? Well, you say, well, look, if I had made in my argument a crucial premise of the following sort, you might have a problem with this. And that would be if I said everything that exists has a cause. But I didn't say that, and I don't believe that. What I believe, and I think you should believe, is that everything that begins to exist has a cause, and that's true of the universe. It's not true of whatever it is that can do that. And that's God. And yet, I get this question all the time. That's how easy it is to respond to that question. Show me, just invite the person to show you in the premises what commits you to the view that if God exists, he has to have a cause. They won't be able to do it. The objection is answered. Now, there are a lot of other interesting objections here to contemplate. I want you to pass an eye over these, and I want to have you turn to page 12. I'll come back to this in a moment. But on page 12 at the top, I want to give you a brief list of suggestions for using the argument. I mean, in addition to what we've talked about, there's some specific practical things to keep in mind. First of all, keep it simple. You say, well, wait a minute. Didn't you already sort of blow it? I mean, Mr. Philosopher. Well, listen, I'm justified in giving you more detail because you're getting equipped, right? And you want to be versatile and well-versed and have as much firepower at your disposal to make sense of these claims. But you don't always have to go out with all guns blazing. I shouldn't have said go out with all guns blazing. You don't always have to be loaded to the hilt with all the details of the argument. Start with simplicity. What is that? Premise number one. Whatever begins to exist as a cause, you guys forgot. Premise number two, the universe began to exist, therefore, the universe has a cause. Okay, what do we say about that? And you fill in the details. All right? That's keeping it simple. If that doesn't do the trick, then give them detail. Find out where they need it. And that's what the second point is. Move to greater subtlety and detail as needed, but not more than needed. And you know what? If you reach your limit and the person is still pressing you for more detail, then go get yourself educated about that. That's when you know it's time to get back into the study and work harder at this. But don't wait trying to master everything before you get into the field. See, there's homework that we do, and there's a certain limit, minimal amount of homework that we must do. But we can't just do homework all the time. We've got to do field work. And it's when you do field work that you actually find out what sort of homework you need to do. All right? So keep that in mind. Set the stage for deploying other evidences in a cumulative case. Don't settle for just using this one argument, in other words. But build it into other things that you can say on behalf of God's existence. Fourth, master the key terms and concepts. Use these as ways of recalling more details. But learn the terminology and learn how to explain it to others. And then finally, understand the chief objections and proper responses. I hope that included in your homework, you will go through these questions for further study that I have left with you on page 12 and begin to read the recommended reading on page 13. But now, because we have time, I want to give you an opportunity to ask your questions, and I want to see if any of them parallel questions that I have listed for you under point number five. Point number five, really listed under point number 5.2. So we'll stop with that, my presentation, and see what you have to say in response. And all you have to do is get out of your seat and come up to one of these two microphones. It's waiting for you. And I'd like to see what your response is and whether there's one of these arguments and objections in particular that you would like to discuss. Thank you. He says we'll start over here.
Hi. I'm just going to state 52532.
Yes.
5231. The concept of an autemporal cause of a temporal series is incoherent. I've had that objection a lot, and one of the responses to that I've heard is that's why God has to be personal. He has to be able to freely act out of his inherent nature of eternity in order to spawn a temporal effect. Is that something you would...
You know, I didn't catch your statement of the argument because I'm behind the speakers, so that's why I've moved forward. And I didn't see it listed as 5.231. Is there a 5.231?
2531, sorry. This is
okay.
A horribly organized
So just tell
question.
Me what that was again. I'm sorry.
The concept of an autemporal cause of a temporal series is incoherent. And the answer to that I've often heard is that's why God must be a personal being. He must freely choose to act outside of his inherent nature of eternity in order to spawn a temporal cause. My question is, doesn't that sound a lot like something popping into existence uncaused out of nothing? And if so, wouldn't Occam's razor just reduce that to the universe came into existence out of nothing?
Yeah. Okay, so the worry here is that you've got something temporal that comes to be and purportedly comes to be as a result of an intentional act on the part of something that's atemporal. Now, how can something that's atemporal perform an act, right? And how can the result of that act be something that's temporal? One of the things always to ask when you get a question of this sort is to have the person spell out the details of the question. Give me an argument, in other words. Why is this a problem? You know? Tell me why it should be a problem for an atemporal being to produce a temporal universe. Now, some people think it's not just atemporality that's a problem here. It's also incorporality. That is, it has no physical body, right? And yet it brings into being physical things. But just to illustrate why that doesn't really seem like a serious issue to me, is if I raise my arm, my view is that there's nothing physical that's doing that. It's a physical event that's brought about in a physical world by an immaterial thing. And that immaterial thing is my mind. So we actually are personally acquainted, intimately acquainted with things like that that are really not that odd, except that we've talked ourselves into thinking that they're odd because we believe people who say, well, we have to be purely physical and nothing else. But the evidence is against that. So if the evidence is against that, even among finite creatures like ourselves, now we're not atemporal, but we have a non-physical, right, substance bringing about a physical event. So that's evidence that that's possible because it is actual. Now, where is the soul? Where's the mind? Where does that exist? It's not physical, so it's not taking up space, right? So where is it? Well, it can't be anywhere because it's not physical. So it can't exist. Can't exist because it's not physical? Well, if it exists, it can't do anything. But it does do things. So you see, a simple way to go about it, though it can get very technical in other directions, is just to say, well, now look at a human act performed by a soul. Something that's not that's not physical, and so not locatable in the same way your body is in any kind of physical space. And yet it performs actions in a physical world. Now, in this case with God, it's not an action in a physical world. It's the action of producing a physical world. But why should that make a difference? So I think that's kind of the short answer that could then expand into various directions, really depending on how your respondent wanted to go. One way they might go is say, well, I just don't believe that we have souls. And now you might actually be grateful that that's what you're talking about. Because that's even more significant, is what is the soul, and is there really such a thing? I'm going to go to the next one.
Thank you.
I think I'm going to ask you about 5.222. We talked about the idea that anything that has a beginning has a cause, or needs to have a cause, and that when we talk about God, God is necessarily existent, and so we don't need a cause for God. So I guess the question then that I would have is, well, then why can't the universe necessarily exist?
Okay, good. Well, the reason why it can't necessarily exist is that it hasn't always existed. You see, if it existed necessarily, well, then it would just exist eternally. That is, if it existed necessarily, it could not not exist. But it did not exist. It does exist, but it did not. But if it's necessary, it could not not exist.
Gotcha. And so that would be when we would go back to like the extension cord analogy or the evidences for it having a beginning point.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Now, somebody might say, well, how about if I retreat to this position and say, well, why can't it just, you know, be that it's always existed? Maybe it's not necessary, but it's always existed. But, you know, we gave arguments, evidence that that's not possible. So now anybody who wants to say that, why isn't that possible, is to say, well, now you have to answer my evidence. You don't have to just try to come up with new evidence on top of the evidence you already presented. They have to reckon with the evidence you gave them. So you say, well, now wait a minute. If you think that's possible, explain that to me. Or if you think that's reasonable, show me why. I'm open to that, but I need to see evidence. I've given you evidence for the other side. You apparently don't accept that, but it's not enough just to reject my evidence without offering another explanation for it. Alternatively, someone might say, well, maybe it just popped into existence willy-nilly out of nothing. One of my Oxford-trained university professors at the PhD level said that in class in a course on the metaphysics of causality. One day he said to us, as we got to the end of the course, you know, where you're running out of things to explain and ways to explain them, evidently, the universe just popped into existence out of nothing. And that was the end of the course. So you say, well, now, is that really a possibility? Some might say, well, it's a logical possibility, but that's uninteresting. We want to know if it's really physically possible because it's physical that happened. What happened is physical. And it has no explanatory power, really, because you're talking about nothing. Now, how does nothing even function in a hypothesis? It's not much of a hypothesis, right? Anyway, some thoughts about that.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to ask you this, and I don't mean it as a trick question or a joke.
Okay.
I want to know the answer to this question.
Okay.
What was God doing before he created the universe? One, and where did he get the raw materials to make it?
Okay.
I mean, at ground zero of the Big Bang, there must have been a massive amount of energy and matter.
Yeah.
And where did it come from?
Well, God wasn't doing anything before the universe was created. You know what I mean by that?
No, I don't.
There was no before.
I'd like to know what you think about this.
Because there was no before. See, for there to be a before the universe was created, in any temporal sense of before, right, you can't have the beginning of time with the creation of the universe. There'd have to be some temporal series first. So you see, God exists in a timeless now. The way we put it is sans creation. So we resort to Latin to speak of this notion that absence any actual universe where God does still exist or does exist, his existence doesn't involve doing things that take time, deliberation, or what have you. He wasn't playing cards. Right? He didn't create the universe out of boredom.
It is a good way to pass the time, but
there was no time. There was no time to pass. See, that's the issue. You know, we have to pass time. God didn't have to pass time. He created time. Now, the other question was, how does he do that without raw materials?
Where did that stuff come from?
Yeah. Well, you and I can't do it. That's one thing we just should know better than to even try. Right? Because how are you going to do it? What are you going to use? Right? But we're just not up to the job, and that includes not really knowing how it's done. And there are a lot of things that we know to be true without knowing how it works. Right?
Yeah.
Lots of things like that.
Lots of things.
So you walked up to a microphone expecting that your voice would be amplified, but a lot of people in here would say, how does that work? They have no doubt that it works until it doesn't, which happens all the time to me. All right? But my point is just that when you have evidence that something is the case, your inability to explain how doesn't provide you with evidence that it's not the case.
Well, I mean,
it just means that you've reached the limit of your understanding up to that point, which might be the limit of the understanding any of us could ever be capable of. And that's just a very important point for all of us to be aware of. You see, it would be another thing if you said, instead of asking me the question, in the spirit of goodwill that you did, if you said, now listen, there is no way that kind of being could have produced a universe with no raw materials. Well, then the burden of proof would be on you, wouldn't it? So why think that? So I don't have to answer the question I don't have to answer an argument that wasn't given to me.
I'm not trying to argue with it.
Exactly.
I'm just asking a question.
Exactly. But somebody else might say, hey, you know, go up there and tell them that it's not possible and can't be done. Well, that can't be done. You can't show that it's not possible. But you can certainly wonder how. And I'm right there with you. And you know what? It's also possible that God couldn't explain it to us. In the sense that we'd actually understand it if he told us. That's possible.
All right, my question might be similar to his, but I mean, it might seem that way. But
yeah.
Maybe you'll understand the way I'm asking.
Okay.
It. If God did in fact create space and time,
yes.
how is it possible for God to think and act outside of time when time, it seems to us, is required for thinking and acting? And if God can in fact think and act outside of time, wouldn't that be a sort of God is a special pleading?
Special pleading?
Yes. Right, where you cite something that he is an exception to a law or something.
Well,
without giving
he has to be an exception. I mean, this is not special pleading if there's reason to think that he's exceptional.
Right.
And he exists in an atemporally and non-spatially. So that's exceptional. So we can't conceptualize acting. We can't project onto God the way we think about performing acting on our intentions in time. That just is not going to work. So however it works, it can't be that. right? So how is it going to work? This, we've come to another question of this sort, but it's not through God grinding out, thinking about, what do I feel like doing? Well, maybe we'll just wait till tomorrow. There is no tomorrow. There's no passage of time with God. And somehow God can intend, will the existence of something, and yet that thing not exist for an infinite amount of time while he's eternal. And I think it's a little bit helpful to see that if the universe existed for an infinite amount of time because God willed it and he was eternal, that wouldn't make the universe eternal in the way that God is. Because the universe would still be temporal and God is eternal, meaning non-temporal. You see what I'm saying there? So it's not like, well, you solve the problem by just saying, well, because he has this will and it just is what it is and there's no temporal quality to it, then there just should be a universe as long as he wills it. As long as, using that as a metaphor. Okay, well, that would then, we think, mean it's always existed. But it would always exist as temporal, which God isn't. So how do you make sense of that? So what we've done here is we've kind of worked back and figured out what kinds of answers are not available to us. We haven't found a good reason to think that's not a possibility, that an eternal God can have this will, this intention. But what comes about as a consequence of that willing is something that has not always existed. Now, I've just described what happens, but I haven't explained it, and I don't think I can.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. They're going to tell me to stop here in a minute.
You mentioned earlier in your speech that God can't provide overwhelming evidence for his existence, or it would force worship. Since we're not all currently forced to worship, are you then implicitly saying that we don't have sufficient evidence for God? And how do you square that position with the idea that Satan has direct experience with God and is still able to rebel?
Look, that's a great question. The question was about whether I think that there is sufficient evidence for the existence of God, independent of the evidence God himself could produce, when it sounds like I think that there isn't, because that would seem coercive. But you see, sufficient evidence to justify a belief is not, as such, coercive. Many of us, maybe all of us, have had times when we believe something that we shouldn't, given the evidence we have. Right? Or we believe something on the evidence that we do have, and we think that's the reasonable thing to believe, but we also think that if we didn't want to, we wouldn't have to believe it. So evidence isn't essentially coercive, and even really, really good evidence isn't essentially coercive. But there is evidence, many people think, that God might give that would coerce them, as if they want that. But their actual dispositions towards God belie their claim to want that. They don't want that. If they wanted that, they would get it in the form of the evidence that only God can provide. So, yes, I think there is ample and sufficient adequate evidence to fully justify the belief that God exists, and this is an example of the kind of evidence that I believe. I wouldn't have rehearsed all that evidence if I didn't believe that. But notice, this is evidence that a proposition is true. We still need to see what its implications are as an appeal to our inner selves. And a lot of people are able to come to the conclusion that God exists on the basis of evidence of this sort and just sort of set the other questions aside, because that's all that they were really thinking about anyway. And so sooner or later, you have got to reckon with God directly, relationally, no matter what the evidence is. But when you do, new evidence comes into play. That's my view.
Well, so what about the question about Satan, though?
So he's justified in believing that God exists just like you and I are.
But he's not forced to worship?
Well, he's supposed to, but he doesn't.
But you said forced. I mean, that was the
word. I don't think he was forced.
But we would be forced if we had perfect knowledge of God, its existence?
I'm saying that God's not going to produce for us the kind of evidence that would coerce us to believe that God exists. Because his interest is in wooing us into relationship. And that's going to include evidence that I believe is conclusive evidence, but it's provided on the condition that that's what you want.
So, but if God were to convince me, are you saying that I would still have the decision to not worship him?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So why doesn't he convince
us? See, the way Paul puts it, the Apostle Paul puts it in Romans 1 is he says, what we do is we suppress the truth. See, if you don't want to believe something for which there's good reason, you try to find good reason to think that the good reasons aren't good.
But
and
why,
so,
why wouldn't he just convince us? I mean, he's God, he can do anything. Why wouldn't he just...
The reason why I said that he wouldn't do that is because of his nature as worthy of worship, which requires a free response on our part to his loving kindness.
But Satan can rebel with perfect knowledge. That means I
he doesn't have perfect knowledge.
Well, he does. Look, perfect knowledge that God exists.
That's right. Look, there are people who believe that God exists and they rebel against God. See, you don't have to be an atheist to resist God or to ignore God. You can believe in God, but just say, hey, you stay where you are. I'm going this way. Right? And I think that's what Satan's doing. Thank you so much. I'm sorry we're out of time. I'd be happy to talk to you sometime else during the conference. Your questions have been great. I'm sure the others would be wonderful too, but we're out of time. Thank you.